museum and is in a shopping mall in Stockholm. Unlike other selfie museums, this one has no works of art on its walls. Instead, its brightly decorated rooms are meant to serve as fun backgrounds for visitors to take their selfies or shoot videos in. Other rooms let the visitors bury themselves in candy-colored foam bricks, strike a pose under neon lights, or sit on a huge colorful swing. The manager says the museum is interactive and lets the visitors be the artists themselves in order to create the art they want to see. The Drone Show Korea 2022 has been held at the Busan Exhibition and Convention Center, BEXCO. It featured 137 companies and 533 booths, making this year's incarnation the largest in the show's six-year history. The event also featured the participation of a large international industry representatives from Japan and Western Europe. A highlight of this year's event was military technology, centered around the unveiling of new indigenous UAVs. This year's show marks a long-endurance liquid hydrogen drone produced by a South Korean company. These developments reflect South Korea's attempt to improve resilience and revolutionize its approach to warfare. The event puts on display the importance of drone industry in various spheres, including defense purposes. More than 163 wildlife species have been released back into lagoons and forests in Colombia's Casanare province after being seized and rehabilitated by authorities fighting wildlife trafficking. These include 15 different species such as anteaters, turtles, macaws, a toucan, and a leopard. They were nurtured back to health by fauna vets from an environmental authority in charge of managing sustainable development. The authority, Corporinoquia, released more than 1,200 animals back into the wild in 2021 alone. Colombia is one of the world's most biodiverse countries by square kilometer and is home to some 10% of the world's flora and fauna.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces, including snipers, occupied the roof of the Al-Aqsa Mosque prayer hall and shattered windows so they could fire live and rubber-coated bullets and tear gas into the house of worship. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading Zionist regime terrorizes Ramadan worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Here's more. The Zionist regime occupation forces attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque, wounding more than 150 Palestinians while it was filled with Ramadan worshippers on one of the holiest days in the Islamic calendar. Six people sustained serious injuries during the hours-long assault on one of the world's most significant religious sites early Friday, April 15th, according to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and more than 400 were arrested. The rights group said that the violence began after thousands of worshippers observed dawn prayers amid the heavy presence of the Zionist regime occupation forces in the area, including on the rooftops of gates to the mosque compound. After the dawn prayer, Palestinians placed wooden barriers around the Al-Aqsa Mosque prayer hall in anticipation of an Israeli raid, PCHR said, and fired firecrackers toward one of the gates where the Zionist regime forces were stationed. Immediately, Israeli occupation forces raided the entire mosque with hundreds of troops and fired live bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, PCHR added. The Zionist regime forces closed off entry to the compound, preventing access to paramedics, and attacked mosque guards, health workers, and media personnel. Al Jazeera reported that one of the guards was shot in the eye with a rubber-coated bullet. PCHR said the Zionist regime forces, including snipers, occupied the roof of the Al-Aqsa Mosque prayer hall and shattered windows so they could fire live and rubber-coated bullets and tear gas into the house of worship. Video shows the upper stained glass windows of the mosque's prayer hall being broken from outside. The Zionist regime forces inside the mosque forced worshippers to lay down and arrested hundreds, PCHR added, before ordering those remaining to evacuate. Video shows worshippers lying on the ground with hands tied behind their backs. Children were also among those arrested. Worshippers were beaten by the Zionist regime forces while evacuating. Three paramedics were injured during the assault, including one who was struck by a rubber-coated bullet in the neck. Three journalists were injured, including photojournalist Rami Khatib, who was beaten by the Zionist regime forces wielding batons. The assault on Khatib was recorded on video. Khatib said that his arm as well as his camera were broken in the Zionist regime's attack. The Zionist regime's foreign ministry attempted to spin the police raid on Al-Aqsa as an effort to protect freedom of worship from violent rioters desecrating the site and endangering the public, though scores of videos show the opposite was the case. Francesca Albanese, the newly appointed UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, stated on Friday, April 15th, that places of worship as an extension of freedom of religion must be protected, especially on holy days. She added that intentional attacks on civilian constitutes war crimes under the Rome Statute, founding the International Criminal Court. That body opened up an investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip last year. Sheikh Ikrimah Sabri, the Imam of Al-Aqsa, called the Zionist regime siege a premeditated and orchestrated attack that aimed to accommodate a raid on the holy site by Israeli extremists during the Passover holiday that began on Friday evening, April 15th. Earlier in the week, an extremist Israeli group that seeks the destruction of the mosque and its replacement with a Jewish temple offered a cash prize for any attempted animal sacrifices on the Al-Aqsa compound during the Passover. On Thursday, April 14th, the Zionist regime arrested six people on suspicion that they intended to perform such a ritual at the holy site. Following the siege on Al-Aqsa, the director of the mosque, Sheikh Omar al-Kaswani, called on worshippers to gather at the holy site to perform Friday prayers and defend it. Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas political office, said on Friday, April 15th, that Palestinians and Muslims would defend and protect Al-Aqsa at any price. A similar Israeli regime assault on the holy site during the Ramadan last year also sparked a military confrontation. More than 250 Palestinians in Gaza, including at least 67 children, were killed during the 11 days of intense violence that followed. Palestinian armed groups, meanwhile, fired thousands of rockets from Gaza during the fighting, killing around a dozen people in the occupied territories. On Friday, April 15th, Palestinians in Gaza protested the Zionist regime's attack on Al-Aqsa earlier that day and deadly repression throughout the West Bank in recent weeks. Some called on Palestinian resistance factions to respond to the occupation violence. Palestinians in Gaza reportedly headed to shops to stock up on essentials in anticipation of a possible major Israeli regime attack on the besieged territory. The Zionist regime imposed a lockdown on Palestinian movement from the West Bank and Gaza Strip at the outset of Passover, as is typical during major Israeli holidays. Also on Friday, April 15th, a Palestinian child died from injuries sustained the previous day during an arrest raid in Kafaran village near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Shaukat Kamal Shaukat Abed, 17, was shot in the stomach while Palestinian youth threw stones at Israeli regime troops withdrawing from the area. Suddenly and without warning, an Israeli troop pointed his gun out the rear window of the vast vehicle in the convoy and began indiscriminately shooting at protesters from a distance of approximately 25 meters, striking the teen and 29-year-old Shas Kemaji, who died from his injuries. Injuries suggest that Shaukat was struck with an exploding bullet that ruptured his blood vessels and veins, Defense for Children International Palestine stated. The rights group added the use of expanding and exploding bullets is a violation of international humanitarian law and amounts to a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Shaukat is the eighth Palestinian child shot and killed by Israeli regime forces in 2022, and the third Palestinian child killed by Israeli regime forces this week, the CIP said. 18 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli regime forces in the West Bank and occupied territories since the beginning of April. Communique.
Whenever people talk about the war in Ukraine, they tend to focus on what's happening inside Ukraine. You know, the battles taking place in Mariupol, the Donbas, or the outskirts of Kiev. But that's just half the story. The war in Ukraine is really a catalyst. It's pushing the world towards a multipolar order. Now, right this moment, we are seeing a global realignment. And I don't just mean the shifting of alliances. We're talking about the future of energy sales, global supply chains, the redistribution of power from the concentrated hands of a few in the West towards Asia. This is a seismic shift, both in size and nature, that could very well determine the future of international politics for the next decade. Now, if I told you 2 months ago that EU member states would be paying for their gas in rubles, you would never have believed me. And yet here we are, where the dominance of the US dollar, of the euro, are being challenged. And while the Western press want you to believe that the whole world is united and has the exact same position on Russia, it couldn't be further from the truth. So maybe it really is time to take a hard look at what the so-called international community really means and where it's headed. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States of America has been the global superpower during the 21st century up until this point, and for the better part of the last century. And one of the things that the U.S. derives much of its power from is its currency, the U.S. dollar. So toward the end of World War II in 1944, you had the Bretton Woods system that was put in place, pegging the U.S. dollar to the gold standard. And as a result, the U.S. dollar de facto became the global reserve currency. And that lasted for a few decades, right? And then from 1968 to 1973, that system fell apart. And what emerged soon thereafter in its place was the petrodollar. The United States, in secret, made an agreement with Saudi Arabia, right? They told the Saudis, we'll give you weapons, we'll give you security. And in exchange, the Saudis would conduct all oil sales in U.S. dollars and buy up U.S. bonds. 80% of all oil transactions are conducted in U.S. dollars. Around 55% of global reserves are in U.S. dollars. But now, because of the war in Ukraine, that could very well change. We've had several shocking developments in the last week that you would have never imagined before, right? So because of the war in Ukraine, the U.S., the EU, they have slapped Russia with sanctions to the point that Russia is now the most sanctioned country on earth with well over 5,530 sanctions. The EU sanctioned everything except Russian energy imports, because the EU relies on Russia, right? About 40% of their gas comes from Russia. However, the UK, the US, they went ahead and straight up banned Russian energy imports. And even though the US isn't a major importer of Russian oil, that announcement of, oh, we're thinking about banning Russian oil, and then actually banning Russian oil, this caused gas prices and oil prices to skyrocket. Oil went up to around $135 a barrel. That's the highest we've seen since July 2008. Gas prices also went up dramatically, Dutch and British. And now all of a sudden, the U.S. is panicking because the U.S. is a net importer of oil. So their oil bill is going way up. And so in order to drive the price back down, the Americans are trying several things, right? First of all, they called up the Saudis and the Emiratis and asked them, please produce more oil. We need to calm global prices. But turns out, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, he won't even take Joe Biden's phone call. You know, apparently they're unhappy because the United States isn't giving them enough support to kill more Yemenis. Then the United States sent a delegation to Venezuela. Remember, Venezuela sits on the world's largest reserves of oil. And the U.S. used to be one of their top customers, you know, until Bush, Obama, Trump sanctioned them into oblivion. And what's funny here is that for years we've been hearing from the U.S. and their allies that Nicolas Maduro is not the president of Venezuela. Apparently, the president is some guy that no one's ever heard of in Venezuela called Juan Guaido. But now, all of a sudden, when the Americans need oil, now they recognize who's the real president, and they're sending a delegation to beg for oil. And again, who are they talking to? Who's the decision maker? Well, I can tell you it's not Juan Guaido, because they went to speak to none other than Maduro. Now, if the Americans are begging Venezuela for oil and begging Maduro for oil, you know the situation is dire. And on top of that, the Americans have tried other ways to bring down oil prices, right? So all of a sudden, after dragging their feet for well over a year, all of a sudden the U.S. wants to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Wow. So remember, the idea is that they lift sanctions on Iran. Iran can put its oil back on the global market, and then oil prices go down because the supply is increased. Well, that didn't happen because of multiple reasons. Russia demanded a written guarantee that Iran won't be hit with fresh sanctions for maintaining ties with Russia. However, it's also been reported there are additional details that had to be ironed out, the terrorism designations and so on. The point is, this sudden enthusiasm and this rush from the Americans to finish up the deal, it really shows their desperation. And the United States have basically sanctioned so many people, they've sanctioned everyone, that they've backed themselves into a corner. And who has the upper hand now? Russia, Iran, Venezuela. Let me tell you, that is quite the twist, right? You're really seeing the tables turn right before you. And to make matters worse for Washington, Saudi Arabia not only refused to take their calls, but was even contemplating selling oil to China, not in U.S. dollars, but in yuan, in China's currency, the renminbi. So basically saying, bye-bye, petrodollar. Remember, the entire premise behind the greenback's value is that major oil sales, energy sales, are denominated in U.S. dollars. Now, China imported roughly 17% of its oil from Saudi Arabia in 2021, so this is no joke. At the same time, instead of sanctioning Russia like everybody else, New Delhi struck a deal with Moscow for 3 million barrels of crude. Now, the amount is irrelevant because India consumes more than that in a single day. But the fact that India traded with Russia, continued to maintain ties with Russia, bought this oil at a discount and in rupees, rubles, so dealing another blow to the US dollar. So China refuses to sanction Russia. India and Pakistan refuse to sanction Russia. They're continuing to buy gas and oil like normal, right, despite the threats to India that it will also face sanctions. That doesn't sound very isolating, right? That's roughly 40% of the world's population there, refusing to toe the Western narrative, refusing to toe the Western line, I should say. And never mind all the other countries that have also refused to condemn Russia. Just look at this map of who has sanctioned Russia. It's basically EU member states, North America, and Japan, and Australia. So in other words, it's the global north, right? This is where all the world's wealth is hoarded. And you know, all the countries that have not sanctioned Russia are mostly countries you would consider the global south, right? So there's an interesting pattern right there. Western governments and media, they keep saying the international community is united against Russia. I'm sorry, that's not what it looks like. The West is not the international community, it's the West, or the global north, if you want to use the new terms, right? So as a matter of fact, it goes further than that. Let's look at these two UN votes. On March 2nd, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution condemning Russia. The overwhelming majority of countries did vote to condemn Russia. That's undeniable. But if you look at who abstained, we have Iran, Iraq, China, India, Pakistan, South Africa. Again, that is enormous. That's well over a third of the world's population, you know, above 40%. We're nearing half the world's population. And so later on March 24th, another General Assembly resolution and pretty much the same result. And 2 days before that, on March 22nd, you had a meeting in Moscow between the Russian foreign minister and who? The ambassadors of all the emerging economic powers, the BRICS, right? So you've got the ambassadors of Brazil, India, China, South Africa, meeting in Moscow with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. Again, that doesn't really look very isolating to me, does it? So you've got the two most populous countries on Earth, two nuclear powers, meeting in Russia's capital with Lavrov. I bet you didn't hear about that on the BBC. Now, Lavrov actually made his first visit to China since the war began just a week later on March 30th. Lavrov actually visited India on April 1st. And now, India has received many visits, many official visits in the past week. You've had officials from the UK, from Greece, Austria, Mexico. They've all come to India. But the only one that India's Prime Minister Modi met with was Lavrov. And again, that pretty much tells you everything you need to know. But this war in Ukraine hasn't been without its setbacks, right? When we talk about a global realignment, that goes both ways. And so we've seen the European Union openly arming Ukraine. That's unprecedented. Germany, the same thing, right? Germany has broken with its past, with its stated stance of neutrality. And Germany's going even further. It's rearming. And I think this is something that not a lot of people really grasp. They don't understand how serious this is, that Germany is rearming. That never ends up well. The last time Germany rearmed, we had a Second World War, we had the Holocaust, we had 30 million dead in Europe alone. And now Germany is basically doing what Donald Trump wanted it to do, what NATO wanted it to do, which is increase their defense spending from 1.5 to 2% of their GDP. So Germany's announced 100 billion euros for its military. That's more than Russia. This is incredible, and it could have very, very severe repercussions down the road. Now, as soon as the war started, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan went to Moscow He not only met with Putin, he also bought 2 million tons of gas and wheat. He refused to condemn Russia at the UN. He refused to sanction Putin. And the Americans took offense to that, right? Because they want countries they can control. And so soon thereafter, Imran Khan unveiled a plot by the United States to oust him, to unseat him from power. Lo and behold, here we are, and Imran Khan has just been ousted via a vote of no confidence. And like all Pakistani prime ministers before him, he didn't get to complete his 5-year term. The Americans are like the mafia, they don't forget, and they punished Imran Khan for daring to conduct an independent foreign policy. And that's the grim reality, right? That shifting towards a multipolar world doesn't come without a price, and the American empire will kick and scream and take down as many with it as it can. To punish Russia, we've seen many corporations pulling out, from McDonald's to Instagram, you name it. And among those are credit card giants Visa and MasterCard, which is actually not that smart when you think about it, because what they basically done is they handed their market share in Russia to China, right? Because as soon as they left, China's UnionPay came into Russia and linked up with Russia's payment system, Mir, M-I-R. And to make things even more interesting, while all this was happening, Iran and Venezuela started talks to link their payment systems to Russia's Mir. So, you know, further enlarging the cooperation, the international cooperation between these countries, further enhancing the economic ties between the axis of resistance, between the global south. So the West attempts to crush Russia's financial system, you know, by freezing roughly half of the Russian central bank's foreign assets. They haven't entirely succeeded, because as a matter of fact, if you look right now at the value of the Russian ruble, it's regained a lot of its value. It's almost back to pre-war levels at 80 rubles to the dollar. And of course, there are people who say, well, this is just artificial, it's just temporary. Yeah, but it's still astounding. You know, Russian President Vladimir Putin told the Russian Central Bank, and he told Gazprom, the state-owned gas company, to come up with a plan by March 31st to make sure that all gas payments from unfriendly countries be conducted in rubles, not euros or dollars. And again, this is a monumental shift, because as we were saying, most oil and energy transactions are denominated in US dollars. Actually, most of Russia's gas sales to Europe are in euros. And so when Putin says unfriendly countries, he's talking mostly about the EU, the US, Japan, Norway, the countries that sanctioned Russia. And that alone helped shore up the value of the ruble, as European countries, which again, collectively, they get 40% of their gas from Russia. So, you know, they have no choice. They have to go now to Gazprom Bank and open an account in rubles, where their euros will be taken, they'll be sold for rubles in their name at the Moscow Stock Exchange, and then pay for the gas, then also used to pay for the gas in their name. So not only does that drive up the demand for rubles, but it's also smart because it means European buyers are now opening accounts at a Russian bank and not the other way around. So this further insulates both the money itself by keeping it in Russia and Gazprom Bank from potential sanctions in the future. And Joe Biden, the US president, he made clear that there will be food shortages as a result of the conflict. Benchmark gas prices have gone through the roof. People in the US are paying $4 a gallon now. And yes, there was already an energy and fuel crisis before the war. But the Americans and the Europeans have essentially taken a bad situation and made it 3 times worse. Don't go anywhere. We'll continue breaking down the shift to a multipolar world right after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So as we were looking at the other week in Yemen, when the price of fuel goes up, everything goes up, because fuel is one of the most important commodities and affects everything from healthcare to public transport to groceries. Now, earlier I spoke to Scott Ritter about his take on things. Scott is a former intelligence officer in the US Marine Corps. He also served as a United Nations weapons inspector and offers formidable insight, not just in combat-related matters, but international affairs, and what it means exactly, you know, transitioning to a multipolar world.
The war in Ukraine is, it's a cleansing moment, and that, I don't mean that in a good way. You know, it's like, you know, let's say you have a forest that's full of trees that are infected with, you know, with fungus and insects and all that. And then you have a forest fire come through and burn it all down. That's not necessarily a good thing, except that what emerges in the aftermath of that fire is a viable forest with healthy trees that'll grow better and produce, you know, have a better impact on the environment. What existed prior was just a festering cesspool of, you know, of infection. The world today is a festering cesspool of infection because of the United States, because of our efforts to impose unilateral hegemony over the world. Ukraine, you know, you can't make the transition from that to what Russia and China are seeking to do without a forest fire. And Ukraine is that forest fire. And it's sad for the Ukrainian people. It's sad for the world. But I think that, for instance, Russia's economic addiction to the West is being broken because of this. The impetus necessary to get Russia to make the strategic pivot away from the West to China and Eurasia is only happening because of this. The liberation of the Russian government from the economic infection of Western influence and the role played by the oligarchs. This is a cleansing moment. There is going to be a radical realignment of centers of gravity in the world. The singular polarity that exists is being broken apart, and it's going to be spread out. And BRICS is probably the initial model of where these centers of gravity are going to, the new centers of gravity are going to emerge.
So, you know, the Russians have demanded that quote-unquote unfriendly countries start paying for gas in rubles, right? So Hungary, they've just announced that they will follow, they will comply, and they're effectively breaking ranks with the EU in saying that. Do you think there's going to be a domino effect? Do you think the other countries will follow suit?
Absolutely. They have no choice. Austria. How does Austria think it's going to get its gas? Austria is going to be paying in rubles. The Vatican is going to be paying in rubles. Slovakia is going to be paying in rubles. And Germany is going to be paying in rubles. They claim they're not going to be. But when the economic reality of what's about to happen to Germany hits home, and I would be willing to put money on the fact that Scholz won't survive the year.
Well, how long do you think that people in the West will tolerate these conditions? You know, higher gas prices, higher food prices. You know, just for the sake of what's being sold in the media as, oh, we're projecting European values and Western values. I mean, how long do you think this is going to go on for? Do you think, you know, there will come a breaking point, or do you think the media are so good at propagandizing people that everyone's just going to tolerate it?
You know, the media works when people come home and they have heat, they have food, and they have comfort. The media doesn't work when you come home and you're cold and you're hungry and you're uncomfortable. There's no amount of propaganda that can change those realities. And the, you know, how long is this going to last till the next election? It's over. There's not a single democracy that will have its current government survive the next election if this policy stays in place and the economies of that country tank. No government will survive a tanking economy. None. Now, in the United States, we don't have a parliamentarian system. So it's pretty much accepted right now that the Congress, that we have a midterm election coming up in November, and that the Republicans are going to gain control of Congress because the Democrats can't spin this. No matter how much Americans claim they support the Ukrainians, at the end of the day, high gas prices, high food prices are going to basically dictate that the government in power has failed.
So Russia have pegged the ruble to gold. What do you make of that?
Russia has done something very clever. I mean, how many people before this crisis thought that that Putin would link the ruble to the gold standard? But it happened, and it was a genius move, because now the ruble, believe it or not, is dictating it, because the price of gold used to be linked to the dollar. I mean, you know, it was all based upon the dollar. But now, by saying that I think it's 5,000 rubles are worth a half a gram of gold or something like that, that value doesn't change. At the end of the day, 5,000 rubles are worth this much gold. And so now it's the dollar that is linked to the ruble, and he's flipped the script. And again, this isn't a temporary measure designed to, if there hadn't been the divorce of the economies, then I would say there's a chance that this is just games. But there's been the divorce of the economy, so there's literally no impetus, no reason for Russia to play temporary games, because they're not going back to the dollar. They're not going back to the euro. They're not going back to the way things were. They're starting anew. This is about empowering the ruble to function in a trans-Eurasian market, not in an American market, not in a European market, but in a trans-Eurasian market as part and parcel of a currency flux that includes the yuan, the rupee, and other currencies as co-equal currencies of joint, you know, that can be jointly traded. No, Russia, this is the new reality.
You know, let's be clear. This isn't like sanctioning Syria or Iran or Venezuela. The U.S. and the EU, they're so used to bullying smaller countries with zero consequences. But this time, the sanctions go both ways. You know, these bureaucrats in Brussels, they're ready to hurt their own people just to spite Russia. But of course, it's okay for them because they're not the ones who are going to lose their jobs or feel the bite of higher gas prices and food prices. Russia isn't an economic giant like the United States, but it does play a strategic role, and it supplies a good chunk of Europe's gas. You can't just go, yeah, we're going to punish the Russians and forget about it. The ripple effect is going to be enormous. And the West have really shot themselves in the foot, right? Sure, they think they're punishing Russia in the short term, but in the long term, they've helped to speed up the process of de-dollarization and the emergence of a stronger Asia. You know, the West are basically begging Russia and China to find alternatives to SWIFT, to conduct oil and gas sales in denominations other than the US dollar, so either in rupees, rubles, or renminbi. Just to give you another example, on April 8th, China began buying coal and oil from Russia in renminbi. Again, the West are pushing Russia into China's arms and encouraging the global south to break free of the Western financial and monetary system, and proving just how important China's Belt and Road Initiative and greater Eurasia will be in the future. It's astonishing how the war in Ukraine has led to so many changes on a global scale and sped up the transition to a multipolar world, undermining U.S. hegemony in the process. Now again, no one is saying at the flick of a switch we're going to wake up tomorrow and find a multipolar world, but things certainly appear to be shifting in that direction at a faster pace than ever before. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of people have held protest after police in Grand Rapids, Michigan, released three videos of a white police officer shooting a black man dead. Patrick Loyal, 26, was fatally shot on April 4th in what activists refer to as the latest example of police violence against young black men. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Nina Lakhani titled, "That Was My Beloved Son." Family of Patrick Loya say police killed their son in an execution. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. The grief-stricken parents of the black man shot in the back of the head by a white Michigan police officer have described their son's death as an execution. Patrick Loya, 26-year-old Congolese refugee, was killed after a traffic stop in Grand Rapids on April 4th. His father, Peter Loya, on Thursday, April 14th, through an interpreter, said, "I didn't believe that there is a genocide in this country," adding, "I didn't know that here in America, there can be execution style to be killed by the police officer." The Loya family came to the U.S. fleeing violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2014. Patrick, a factory worker, was the eldest of six children and had two young daughters. Video footage released by the Grand Rapids police chief on Wednesday, April 13th, shows a short foot chase on a residential street after Loya ran from the officer who stopped him for driving with a license plate that didn't belong to the vehicle. They are shown briefly struggling over the officer's taser before he apparently shoots Loya in the back of the head while kneeling on his back. Peter Loya said, "It made me cry to see my son killed by a police officer for a small mistake," adding, "My heart was really broken. My life was Patrick, my son. I was thinking Patrick will take my place, and to see that my son was killed like an animal by this U.S. police officer." Lawyers for the family said the officer should be prosecuted, fired, and named. Peter said Patrick's brothers and sisters want to know who killed him and would like to see his picture so they can know this is the person that took our beloved one. The officer has been placed on paid leave with his police powers suspended while Michigan State Police conduct a criminal investigation. Police bosses have said he will not be identified publicly unless there are criminal charges. A rally took place in Grand Rapids on Friday, April 15th, as protests supporting the family's call for justice have grown since the video footage was released. But prosecutor Chris Becker, who will decide whether any charges are brought against the 7-year veteran officer and had objected to the footage being released, said not to expect a quick decision. Grand Rapids is a small city of about 200,000 people located about 150 miles northwest of Detroit, where, like many places in the U.S., the police have faced criticism over the use of excessive force, particularly against black people, who made up 18% of the population. At the news conference inside Renaissance Church of God in Christ in Grand Rapids on Thursday, April 14th, Loyal's parents explained that they sought asylum in the U.S. looking for safety after years of civil unrest and violence at home in eastern Congo. His mother, Dorcas Loya, told the Free Press through translator, "They told us that in America there is peace, there is safety, you're not going to see killing anymore, that it was basically a safe haven," adding, "What is so surprising? The man supposed to be protecting us is the one who shot my son," she said. "That was my beloved son. You know how I love your firstborn son." The family were accompanied by their attorneys and the mother of Breonna Taylor, a black woman, a native of Grand Rapids, shot dead inside her home by police in Louisville, Kentucky in 2020. Ben Crump, a prominent civil rights lawyer who has represented several victims of police violence, as Patrick's parents wept, said, "The video shows us that this is, as his mother and father have said, an execution, and there is no way to spin it or justify," adding, "It is an unjustifiable use of deadly force because the police escalated a traffic stop into an execution." Crump said the officer could have waited for backup when Loyal ran out, but instead got violent. He accused the unidentified officer of breaking protocol by using taser while close to Loya, adding that it was natural instinct for Loya to try to avoid being stunned. Crump said there was no reason for the officer to have any intimate fear of the taser being used against him. The Loya family first escaped from DRC to Malawi, where they were granted asylum to live in the U.S. In recent years, Congolese people have become the largest group settled in Michigan, overtaking refugees from West Asia after Donald Trump made it virtually impossible for Arab and Muslim people to gain asylum in the U.S. The family lawyers pointed to the language barriers Congolese and others face when dealing with police. Crump said, "We were condemning Takfiri terrorists for shooting civilians in Iraq and Syria in the back of the head," adding, "Why aren't we condemning police officers here in the United States of America shooting black civilians in the back of the head? If it was wrong in Iraq and Syria, it's wrong in Grand Rapids, Michigan." Dorcas described her eldest son as the type of person you would want to be around and said he would often make her laugh. "Details of the funeral are expected soon," Dorcas said. "As a parent, I was thinking that maybe it was my son who was going to bury me, assist me at my funeral," adding, "But it is astonishing. I am the one burying my son." Hundreds of people have held protests after police in Grand Rapids, Michigan, released three videos of the white police officer shooting the black man dead. The three videos were taken from the dashboard of the officer's squad car, from his body-worn camera, and from a neighbor's surveillance camera. After the videos were released on Wednesday, April 13th, demonstrators marched through the city's downtown carrying Black Lives Matter placards and chanted, "No justice, no peace." Brian Foster, a black man who attended demonstrations, said, "I don't think the establishment are ever gonna listen to us," adding, "It's in their best interest not to. It's in their best interest to keep this war against my people going forever." Meanwhile, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, issued a written statement saying, "Another black man has died at the hands of police, and the officer in this video has got to be held accountable." The NAACP said President Biden signed the police reform executive order now. "While we fully understand an executive order is not a substitute for meaningful legislation, we must do everything in our power to protect our community." Massive protests have been held across the country following the killings of African-American men, George Floyd and Daunte Wright, by white police officers in 2020. Floyd's death in May 2020 sparked angry protests across the U.S. and across the world. The protests evolved into a nationwide battle between progressives and far-right groups after former President Donald Trump took a hardline stance against the anti-racism protests.
Aperture. Welcome back. In the first part of the aperture, we witnessed various communities which have walled themselves in so that others may be kept out. In urban France, the middle class has increasingly retreated into gated communities. Likewise, in Rio de Janeiro, the middle class seeks to avoid the slums literally across the road from their gated condominiums. Stay with us for more as we explore the wall in Iraq, which American forces have constructed to cordon off the areas of Baghdad.
Abu Hazm's children go to school in Doura, within the walls that encircle the area. So, who wants the wall torn down? No one wants to keep it. What do you think will happen in the future? In Doura, our neighbourhood. Yes, Ali. I want more peace and no more walls and gardens. Sports clubs. Better education. So, less walls and more schools. I want to go to hospital without problems. How about you, Hausa? Take the walls away so I can get to the stadium easily. Tell me, what do you think when you see the walls? We're enclosed. It's like prison. I've tried to reassure them about the future. We talk about it, of their vision, and we all hope things will work out. Life doesn't stand still, it evolves. In the areas closest to the walls, the locals are particularly angry. Look, it's a prison. To go to the market, I need to take a taxi and another one to come back. And the market is only a few steps away, behind the wall. And during school, it's even worse. The kids get all muddy. Okay, I know they want to stop the terrorists, but they could take away two pieces of the wall to make our lives a bit easier. It really affects us. I mean, from dawn till dusk, all we see is this wall. We all know each other here. We all have different religions, but there are no problems. The other wall drives me nuts. Look at my legs. I'm sick, and I don't have a car to get there. How am I meant to go to hospital? We're all depressed. Put yourself in our place. If you woke up and had this wall right in front of you every day, what would you do? Tell me. In February 2011, Iraqi demonstrators take part in the Arab Spring. They protest having to live walled up. In the weeks that follow the demonstrations, the government will organize a large-scale communications campaign. The Ministry of Interior takes two busloads of journalists to the areas once held by the insurgents, and now completely walled off. Good morning, sir. Now, would it help you if we remove some parts of the wall? Oh, yes, sir. The wall was very harmful to us, but it also brought you safety. Well, to begin with, yes, but that's all over now. So what would you like then? Leave the wall or take it away? Take it away, please. Where will we put it? Wherever you like. The next morning, it's back to the same area to see if the work is continuing. The crane has disappeared. Just the residents remain, as angry as ever. They never tell the truth. They promised the wall would be gone in a week. Nothing's changed. They say yes, 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 today for sure. And then they come back 2 years later. They built this wall as a barrier between my neighbors and myself. They should take it down and put it on the border with Saudi Arabia. They should have police patrols, not walls. In our brave new world, the differences between military and civilian security technology are becoming blurred. What the army invents to protect its own bases, gated communities adopt for the benefit of individuals.
So when the arm goes down, the teeth come up automatically. That way, if a vehicle tries to ram through the arm, they're going to shred their tires.
Now you have digital zoom while recording the entire area, so you're not losing any video coverage while tracking a person or an automobile that might be coming onto your property.
You can present a card, and then this this sends the data stream to an access controller, so you can select when someone can get in and when they can get out.
We can put our software, it can be loaded on a smartphone, so if there's a violation at the north gate coming into the gated community, the guard can get an alert on his smartphone with the video clip.
There's like an integration of military materials and civilian materials in terms of security nowadays.
Correct. For residential use, it's just a lighter duty machine, as opposed for things that are built specifically for military or border operations. They have to be much heavier duty.
Thais's mother wants to buy an apartment in this condominium that is even more luxurious than their own. But it's even further from the center of Rio. Regis lives on the other side of the railings, just a few meters away, but has never stepped foot inside.
Do you have any friends inside?
Very few. Well, actually, none. I don't know anyone. But, you know, I don't want to climb the wall that encircles them. I'm not interested in that. I'm just not curious about what it's like inside. I know the kind of person that lives there. My boss, for example. I've never been to his house, but I've got a pretty good idea what it's like. White shirt, yellow tie. Security is very polite. And they don't miss a thing. It's like a labyrinth, a maze. You go in one side and out the other. At least there is an exit. Regis might have said no, but passing the splendid houses every day, he does dream of winning the lottery. Yeah, of course, I'd buy myself a beautiful place. A manor even, with a football pitch, a pool, barbecue. And what about security? I don't know if I'd have any. Maybe a camera. And a pit bull. Compared to the favelas in Rio, the Mirai housing estates are havens of tranquility. Hey, no scooters here. It's no good. There are people who live here. And it's not good for the kids. Go on, guys. All they have in common is the absence of the state. When his neighborhood became dangerous for the public services, Zubir spoke to the housing administration about controlling the rowdier elements. The mediator's method is to be firm, but not unpleasant. And there's a place available until midnight for the kids who have nowhere else to go. In the past, it was the community police that did this kind of work. Jean-Pierre Avrin used to be the head of the Toulouse police. He's now left the national force and is working for the municipal police. He'd set up a community policing project in the housing estates of Mirai. The video is barely 10 years old, but is now almost historic, certainly unusual. Relaxed-looking police in shirt sleeves in Mirai. The police should not be cut off from the people. It won't be effective. The police have to be close to the citizens. It's the only way to make it work. I think the community police I knew was well-liked by the residents. They used to call the youngsters by their first names. And instead of fining them something straight away, they'd say, "Oh, if you could move your car, please, that would be great." They spoke to the kids, and the kids would shake their hands. Now, if you shake a policeman's hands, you'd be considered an informer. Nicolas Sarkozy puts an end to community policing when he is the Interior Minister in 2003. He summons Avrin and his men before the cameras to let them know he's not pleased by their results. There are many of you where the delinquents are.